People's emotions are rarely put into words. Far more often, they're expressed through other cues. The key to intuiting another's feelings is in the ability to read nonverbal channels, tone of voice, gesture, facial expression, and the like. In tests with over 7,000 people in the U.S. and 18 other countries, the benefits of being able to read feelings from nonverbal cues included being better adjusted emotionally, more popular, more outgoing, and perhaps not surprisingly, more sensitive. In general, women are better than men at this kind of empathy. The moment Hope, just 9 months old, saw another baby fall, tears welled up in her own eyes, and she crawled off to be comforted by her mother, as though it were she who had been hurt. And 15-month-old Michael went to get his own teddy bear for his crying friend Paul. When Paul kept crying, Michael retrieved Paul's security blanket for him. Both these small acts of sympathy and caring were observed by mothers trained to record such incidents of empathy in action. The results of the study suggest that the roots of empathy can be traced to infancy. Virtually from the day they're born, infants are upset when they hear another infant crying, a response some see as the earliest precursor of empathy. Developmental psychologists have found that infants feel sympathetic distress even before they fully realize that they exist apart from other people. Even a few months after birth, infants react to a disturbance in those around them as though it were their own, crying when they see another child's tears. On seeing his mother cry, one baby wiped his own eyes, though they had no tears. Such motor mimicry, as it's called, fades from toddlers' repertoire at around 2.5 years, at which point they realize that someone else's pain is different from their own. Daniel Stern, a psychiatrist at Cornell University School of Medicine, is fascinated by the small, repeated exchanges that take place between parent and child. He believes that the most basic lessons of emotional life are laid down in these intimate moments. Of all such moments, the most critical are those that let the child know her emotions are met with empathy, accepted and reciprocated, in a process Stern calls attunement. Stern contends that the countlessly repeated moments of attunement or misattunement between parent and child shape the emotional expectations adults bring to their close relationships, perhaps far more than the more dramatic events of childhood. Attunement is very different from simple imitation. If you just imitate a baby, Stern told me, that only shows you know what he did, not how he felt. To let him know you sense how he feels, you have to play back his inner feelings in another way. Then the baby knows he's understood. The lifetime emotional costs of lack of attunement in childhood can be great, not just for the child. A study of criminals who committed the cruelest and most violent crimes found that neglect set them apart from other criminals. They'd been shuttled from foster home to foster home or raised in orphanages, life histories that suggest little opportunity for attunement. Never send to know for whom the bell tolls, it tolls for thee. That's one of the most famous lines in English literature. John Donne's sentiment speaks to the heart of the link between empathy and caring. Another's pain is one's own. To feel with another is to care. The empathic attitude is engaged again and again in moral judgments for dilemmas involving potential victims. Should you lie to keep from hurting a friend's feelings? Should you keep a promise to visit a sick friend or accept a last-minute invitation to a dinner party instead? When should a life support system be kept going for someone who would otherwise die? These moral questions are posed by the empathy researcher Martin Hoffman, who argues that the roots of morality are to be found in empathy, since it's empathizing with the potential victims, someone in pain, danger, or deprivation, say, and so sharing their distress, that moves people to act to help them. Hoffman sees a natural progression in empathy from infancy onward. By late childhood, the most advanced level of empathy emerges as children are able to understand distress beyond the immediate situation and to see that someone's condition or station in life may be a source of chronic distress. At this point, they can feel for the plight of an entire group, such as the poor, the oppressed, the outcast. That understanding in adolescence can buttress moral convictions centered on wanting to alleviate misfortune and injustice. Empathy is typically and tragically lacking in those who commit the most mean-spirited of crimes. A psychological fault line is common to rapists, child molesters, and many perpetrators of family violence alike. They are incapable of empathy. This inability to feel the victim's pain allows them to tell themselves lies that encourage their crime. For rapists, the lies include, women really want to be raped, or if she resists, she's just playing hard to get. For molesters, it's, I'm not hurting the child, just showing love, or this is just another form of affection. For physically abusive parents, it's, this is just good discipline. As so often happens to five-year-olds with younger siblings, Len has lost all patience with Jay, his two-and-a-half-year-old brother, who's making a mess of the Lego blocks they've been playing with. Carried away by a wave of rage, Len bites Jay, who breaks into tears. Their mother, hearing Jay's pained yelp, bustles over and scolds Len, ordering him to put away these objects of contention, the Lego blocks. At this, what surely must seem a gross miscarriage of justice, Len bursts out crying. Still peeved, his mother refuses to console him. But Len is proffered comfort from an unlikely source, Jay, who, although the original injured party, is now so concerned by his older brother's tears that he undertakes a campaign to calm Len down. He says, Len, don't. Stop crying. But Len still cries. His direct plea a failure, Jay beseeches their mother on Len's behalf. Len crying, Mummy. Look, me show you Len crying. And then turning to Len, Jay adopts a mothering mode, patting his weeping brother as he reassures him in soothing tones. Look, Len, no go on crying. Len's sobs continue, so Jay turns to another tactic, lending a helping hand and putting away the Lego blocks in their bag. I put it back for Lenny. Even so, the tears continue. The ever-ingenious Jay tries yet another strategy, distraction. Showing his brother a toy car, Jay tries to draw his attention away from the minor tragedy that's just befallen him. There's this man in here. What's this, Len? Len takes no interest. He's inconsolable. His tears know no end. Losing her patience with him, his mother resorts to that classic parental threat. Do you want me to smack you? Then just stop it, please. Len manages a pathetic, I'm trying to, which prompts Jay's final stratagem. Borrowing his mother's firmness and voice of authority, he threatens, Stop crying, Len. Smack your bottom. This microdrama reveals the remarkable emotional sophistication that a toddler of just 30 months can bring to bear in trying to manage someone else's emotions. In his urgent attempts to soothe his brother, Jay is able to draw on a large repertoire of tactics ranging from a simple plea, to seeking an ally in his mother, to physically comforting him, to lending a helping hand, to distraction, threats, and direct commands. No doubt Jay relies on an arsenal that has been tried with him in his own moments of distress. No matter, what counts is that he can readily put them to use in a pinch, even at this very young age. To manifest such interpersonal power, toddlers must first reach a benchmark of self-control, the beginnings of the capacity to damp down their own anger and distress, their impulses and excitement, even if that ability usually falters. Attunement to others demands a modicum of calm in oneself. Tentative signs of this ability to manage their own emotions emerge around this same period. Patience emerges as an alternative to tantrums, at least occasionally. And signs of empathy emerge by age 2. It was Jay's empathy, the root of compassion, that drove him to try so hard to cheer up his sobbing brother Len. Thus handling emotions in someone else, the fine art of relationships, requires the rightness of 2 other emotional skills, self-management and empathy. With this base, the people skills ripen. These are the social competencies that make for effectiveness in dealings with others. Deficits here lead to ineptness in the social world or repeated interpersonal disasters. Indeed, it's precisely the lack of these skills that can cause even the intellectually brightest to founder in their relationships, coming off as arrogant, obnoxious, or insensitive. These social abilities allow one to shape an encounter, to mobilize and inspire others, to thrive in intimate relationships, to persuade and influence, to put others at ease. It's recess at a preschool, and a band of boys is running across the grass. Reggie trips, hurts his knee, and starts crying, but the other boys keep right on running. except for Roger, who stops. As Reggie's sobs subside, Roger reaches down and rubs his own knee, calling out, "I hurt my knee too." Roger is cited as having exemplary interpersonal intelligence by Thomas Hatch, a colleague of Howard Gardner at Spectrum, the school based on the concept of multiple intelligences. Roger, it seems, is unusually adept at recognizing the feelings of his playmates and making rapid, smooth connections with them. It was only Roger who noticed Reggie's plight and pain, and only Roger who tried to provide some solace, even if all he could offer was rubbing his own knee. This small gesture bespeaks a talent for rapport, an emotional skill essential for the preservation of close relationships, whether in a marriage, a friendship, or a business partnership. Such skills in preschoolers are the buds of talents that ripen through life. Roger's talent represents one of four separate abilities that Hatch and Gardner identify as components of interpersonal intelligence. The components include organizing groups, the essential skill of the leader. This involves initiating and coordinating the efforts of a network of people. Another is negotiating solutions, the talent of the mediator, preventing conflicts or resolving those that flare up. Another is personal connection, Roger's talent, that of empathy and connecting. It's the art of relationship. Finally, there's social analysis, being able to detect and have insights about people's feelings, motives, and concerns. Taken together, these skills are the stuff of interpersonal polish, the necessary ingredients for charm, social success, even charisma. If the test of social skill is the ability to calm distressing emotions in others, then handling someone at the peak of rage is perhaps the ultimate measure of mastery. Such refined skill in the fine art of emotional influence is perhaps best exemplified by a story told by an old friend, the late Terry Dobson, who in the 1950s was one of the first Americans ever to study the martial art Aikido in Japan. One afternoon, Terry was riding home on a suburban Tokyo train when a huge, bellicose, very drunk and begrimed laborer got on. The man, staggering, began terrorizing the passengers. Screaming curses, he took a swing at a woman holding a baby, sending her sprawling into the laps of an elderly couple, who then jumped up and joined a stampede to the other end of the car. The drunk grabbed the metal pole in the middle of the car with a roar and tried to tear it out of its socket. At that point, Terry, who was in peak physical condition from daily 8-hour Aikido workouts, felt called upon to intervene lest someone get seriously hurt. But he recalled the words of his teacher, "Aikido is the art of reconciliation. Whoever has the mind to fight has broken his connection with the universe. If you try to dominate people, you are already defeated. We study how to resolve conflict, not how to start it." Terry stood up, slowly and with deliberation. Seeing him, the drunk roared, "Aha! A foreigner! You need a lesson in Japanese manners!" But just as the drunk was on the verge of making his move, someone gave an ear-splitting, oddly joyous shout, "Hey!" The shout had the cheery tone of someone who has suddenly come upon a fond friend. The drunk, surprised, spun around to see a tiny Japanese man, probably in his 70s. The old man beamed with delight at the drunk and beckoned him over with a light wave of his hand and a lilting, "Hey, come here!" The drunk strode over with a belligerent, "Why the hell should I talk to you?" Meanwhile, Terry was ready to fell the drunk in a moment if he made the least violent move. "What you been drinking?" said the old man. "I've been drinking sake, and it's none of your business." The old man said, "Oh, that's wonderful. I love sake, too. Every night, me and my wife, we warm up a little bottle of sake and take it out into the garden, and we sit on an old wooden bench." He continued on about the persimmon tree in his backyard, the fortunes of his garden, enjoying sake in the evening. The drunk's face began to soften as he listened to the old man, his fists unclenched. The old man said, "And I'm sure you have a wonderful wife." "No, my wife died." Sobbing, the laborer launched into a sad tale of losing his wife, his home, his job, of being ashamed of himself. Just then the train came to Terry's stop, and as he was getting off, he turned to hear the old man invite the drunk to join him and tell him all about it, and to see the drunk sprawl along the seat, his head in the old man's lap. That is emotional brilliance. To love and to work, Sigmund Freud once remarked to his disciple Erik Erikson, are the twin capacities that mark full maturity. If that's the case, then maturity may be an endangered way station in life, and current trends in marriage and divorce make emotional intelligence more crucial than ever. Consider divorce rates. Although the overall rate of divorce has stopped climbing, the risk of divorce has been shifting to newlyweds. The shift gets clearer in comparing divorce rates for couples wed in a given year. For American marriages that began in 1890, about 10% ended in divorce. For couples married in 1950, 30%. And for married couples starting out in 1990, the likelihood that the marriage would end in divorce was projected to be close to a staggering 67%. If the estimate holds, just 3 in 10 of recent newlyweds can count on staying married to their new partner. She seeks to engage, he withdraws. Marital therapists have long noted that by the time a couple finds their way to the therapy office, they're in this pattern of engage-withdraw, with his complaint about her so-called unreasonable demands and outbursts, and her lamenting his indifference to what she's saying. This marital endgame reflects the fact that there are, in effect, two emotional realities in a couple, his and hers. The roots of these emotional differences, while they may be partly biological, also can be traced back to childhood and to the separate emotional worlds boys and girls inhabit while growing up. There's a vast amount of research on these separate worlds, their barriers reinforced not just by the different games boys and girls prefer, but by young children's fear of being teased for having a girlfriend or boyfriend. One study of children's friendships found that 3-year-olds say about half their friends are of the opposite sex. For 5-year-olds, it's about 20%, but by age 7, almost no boys or girls say they have a best friend of the opposite sex. These separate social universes intersect little until teenagers start dating. Meanwhile, boys and girls are taught very different lessons about handling emotions. Parents, in general, discuss emotions, with the exception of anger, more with their daughters than their sons. Girls are exposed to more information about emotions than are boys. At age 10, roughly the same percent of girls as boys are overtly aggressive, given to open confrontation when angered. But by age 13, a telling difference between the sexes emerges. Girls become more adept than boys at artful aggressive tactics like ostracism, vicious gossip, and indirect vendettas. Boys simply continue being confrontational when argued, oblivious to these more covert strategies. Boys, and later men, are less sophisticated than the opposite sex in the byways of emotional life. When girls play together, they do so in small, intimate groups with an emphasis on minimizing hostility and maximizing cooperation, while boys' games are in larger groups with an emphasis on competition. One key difference can be seen in what happens when games boys or girls are playing get disrupted by someone getting hurt. If a boy who's gotten hurt gets upset, he's expected to get out of the way and stop crying so the game can go on. If the same happens among a group of girls who are playing, the game stops while everyone gathers around to help the girl who's crying. This difference between boys and girls at play epitomizes what Harvard's Carol Gilligan points to as a key disparity between the sexes. Boys take pride in a lone, tough-minded independence and autonomy, while girls see themselves as part of a web of connectedness. This may partly reflect another key difference. Women, on average, experience the entire range of emotions with greater intensity and more volatility than men. In this sense, women are more emotional than men. All of this means that, in general, women come into a marriage groomed for the role of emotional manager, while men arrive with much less appreciation of the importance of this task for helping a relationship survive. How a couple discusses sore points matters greatly for the fate of their marriage. Simply having an agreement about how to disagree is key to marital survival. Men and women have to overcome the innate gender differences in approaching rocky emotions. Failing this, couples are vulnerable to emotional rifts that eventually can tear their relationship apart. These rifts are far more likely to develop if one or both partners have certain deficits in emotional intelligence. Fred, did you pick up my dry cleaning? Ingrid, did you pick up my dry cleaning? Pick up your own damn dry cleaning. What am I, your maid? Fred, hardly. If you were a maid, at least you'd know how to clean. This painfully caustic interchange was between a couple who divorced within the next few years. Their encounter took place in a laboratory run by John Gottman, a psychologist who's done perhaps the most detailed analysis ever of the emotional glue that binds couples together and the corrosive feelings that can destroy marriages. In his laboratory, couples' conversations are videotaped and then subjected to hours of microanalysis designed to reveal the subterranean emotional currents at play. This mapping of the fault lines that may lead a couple to divorce makes a convincing case for the crucial role of emotional intelligence in the survival of a marriage. An early warning signal that a marriage is in danger, Gottman finds, is harsh criticism. In a healthy marriage, husband and wife feel free to voice a complaint, but too often, in the heat of anger, complaints are expressed in a destructive fashion, as an attack on the spouse's character. The differences between complaints and personal criticisms are simple. In a complaint, a wife states specifically what's upsetting her and criticizes her husband's action, not her husband. But personal criticism leaves the person on the receiving end feeling ashamed, disliked, blamed, and defective, all of which are more likely to lead to a defensive response than to steps to improve things. All the more so when the criticism comes laden with contempt, use of mockery or insults such as jerk or bitch. But just as hurtful is the body language that conveys contempt, particularly the sneer or curled lip that are universal facial signals for disgust. The two arms of the fight-or-flight response each represent ways a spouse can respond to an attack. The most obvious is to fight back, lashing out in anger. But the alternative response, fleeing, can be more pernicious, particularly when the flight is a retreat into stony silence. Stonewalling is the ultimate defense. The stonewaller just goes blank, in effect withdrawing from the conversation by responding with a stony expression and silence. Stonewalling sends a powerful, unnerving message, something like a combination of icy distance, superiority, and distaste. As a habitual response, stonewalling is devastating to the health of a relationship. It cuts off all possibility of working out disagreements. The children are being rambunctious, and Martin, their father, is getting annoyed. He turns to his wife, Melanie, and says in a sharp tone, "Dear, don't you think the kids could quiet down?" His actual thought? She's too easy on the kids. Melanie, responding to his ire, feels a surge of anger. Her face grows taut, her brows knit in a frown, and she replies, "The kids are having a good time. Anyhow, they'll be going to bed soon." Her thought, there he goes again, complaining all the time. Martin now is visibly enraged. He leans forward, his fists clenched as he says in an annoyed tone, "Should I put them to bed now?" His thought, "She opposes me in everything. I'd better take over." Melanie, suddenly frightened by Martin's wrath, says meekly, "No, I'll put them to bed right away." Her thought, "He's getting out of control. He could hurt the kids. I'd better give in." This exchange, reported by Aaron Beck, the founder of cognitive therapy, is an example of the kinds of thinking that can poison a marriage. The real emotional exchange between Melanie and Martin is shaped by their thoughts, and those thoughts, in turn, are determined by another deeper layer, which Beck calls automatic thoughts, fleeting background assumptions about oneself and the people in one's life that reflect our deepest emotional attitudes. For Melanie, the background thought is something like, "He's always bullying me with his anger." For Martin, the key thought is, "She has no right to treat me like this." Melanie feels like an innocent victim in their marriage, and Martin feels righteous indignation at what he feels is unjust treatment. These thoughts are powerful. They trip the neural alarm system. Once the husband's thought of being victimized triggers an emotional hijacking, he will, for the time being, easily call to mind and ruminate on a list of grievances that remind him of the way she victimizes him, while not recalling anything she may have done in their entire relationship that would disconfirm the view that he is an innocent victim. Partners who are free of such distress-triggering views can entertain a more benign interpretation of what's going on in the same situations, and so they're less likely to have such a hijacking, or, if they do, tend to recover from it more readily. Perhaps the most virulent of such toxic thoughts are found in husbands who are physically violent to their wives. A study of violent husbands by psychologists at Indiana University found that these men think like schoolyard bullies. They read hostile intent into even neutral actions by their wives and use this misreading to justify to themselves their own violence. The net effect of such distressing attitudes is to create incessant crisis. Gottman uses the term flooding for this susceptibility to frequent emotional distress. Flooded husbands or wives are so overwhelmed by their partner's negativity and by their own reaction to it that they're swamped by dreadful, out-of-control feelings. Flooding is a self-perpetuating emotional hijacking. This is perhaps the most dangerous turning point for a marriage, a catastrophic shift in the relationship. Given the grim potential outcome of the differences in how men and women deal with distressing feelings in their relationship, what can couples do to protect the love and affection they feel for each other? In short, what protects a marriage? Men and women, in general, need different emotional fine-tuning. For men, the advice is not to sidestep conflict, but to realize that when their wife brings up some grievance or disagreement, she may be doing it as an act of love, trying to keep the relationship healthy and on course. Men also need to be on guard against short-circuiting the discussion by offering a practical solution too early on. It's typically more important to a wife that she feel her husband hears her complaint and empathizes with her feelings about the matter, though he need not agree with her. She may hear his offering advice as a way of dismissing her feelings as inconsequential. As for women, the advice is quite parallel. Since a major problem for men is that their wives are too intense in voicing complaints, wives need to make a purposeful effort to be careful not to attack their husbands, to complain about what they did, but not criticize them as a person or express contempt. Complaints are not attacks on character, but rather a clear statement that a particular action is distressing. An angry personal attack will almost certainly lead to a husband's getting defensive or stonewalling, which will be all the more frustrating and only escalate the fight. It helps, too, if a wife's complaints are put in the larger context of reassuring her husband of her love for him. Most notably, Michigan couples who eventually divorce are attempts by either partner in an argument to de-escalate the tension. The presence or absence of ways to repair a rift is a crucial difference between the fights of couples who have a healthy marriage and those of couples who eventually end up divorcing. The repair mechanisms are like an emotional thermostat, preventing the feelings being expressed from boiling over and overwhelming the partner's ability to focus on the issue at hand. One overall strategy for making a marriage work is not to concentrate on the specific issues, whether child-rearing, sex, money, or housework, that couples fight about, but rather to cultivate a couple's shared emotional intelligence, thereby improving the chances of working things out. A handful of emotional competencies, mainly being able to calm down and calm your partner, empathy, and listening well, can make it more likely a couple will settle their disagreements effectively. The emotional reactions triggered in marriage touch on some of our deepest needs, to be loved and feel respected, fears of abandonment or of being emotionally deprived. Small wonder we can act in a marital fight as though our very survival were at stake. Even so, nothing gets resolved positively when husband or wife is in the midst of an emotional hijacking. One key marital competence is for partners to learn to soothe their own distressed feelings. Essentially, this means mastering the ability to recover quickly from the flooding caused by an emotional hijacking. Because the ability to hear, think, and speak with clarity dissolves during such an emotional peak, calming down is an immensely constructive step, without which there can be no further progress in settling what's at issue. One method for calming is to have a pre-stated agreement that allows one or another partner to call a timeout at the first signs of flooding in either one. During that timeout period, cooling down can be helped along by engaging in a relaxation technique. Because flooding is triggered by negative thoughts about the partner, it helps if a husband or wife who's being upset by such harsh judgments tackles them head-on. A sentiment like, "I don't deserve this kind of treatment," is an innocent victim or righteous indignation slogan. By catching these thoughts and challenging them, a husband or wife can begin to become free of their hold. Listening is a skill that keeps couples together. The most powerful form of non-defensive listening, of course, is empathy, actually hearing the feelings behind what's being said. Without this physiological attunement, a partner's sense of what the other is feeling is likely to be entirely off base. One method for effective emotional listening, called mirroring, is commonly used in marital therapy. When one partner makes a complaint, the other repeats it back in her own words, trying to capture not just the thought, but also the feelings that go with it. The partner mirroring checks with the other to be sure the restatement is on target, and if not, tries again until it's right, something that seems simple but is surprisingly tricky in execution. The effect of being mirrored accurately is not just feeling understood, but having the added sense of being in emotional attunement. Because these maneuvers are to be called upon during the heat of confrontation, when emotional arousal is sure to be high, they have to be overlearned if they're to be accessible when needed most. For these reasons, the above strategies need to be tried out and rehearsed during encounters that are not stressful if they are to have a chance to become an acquired first response. In essence, these antidotes to marital disintegration are a small remedial education in emotional intelligence. Milburn McBroom was a domineering boss with a temper that intimidated those who worked with him. That fact might have passed unremarked had McBroom worked in an office or factory, but McBroom was an airline pilot. One day in 1978, McBroom's plane was approaching Portland, Oregon, when he noticed a problem with the landing gear. So McBroom went into a holding pattern, circling the field at a high altitude while he fiddled with the mechanism. As McBroom obsessed about the landing gear, the plane's fuel gauges steadily approached the empty level. But his co-pilots were so fearful of McBroom's wrath that they said nothing, even as disaster loomed. The plane crashed, killing 10 people. Today, the story of that crash is told as a cautionary tale in the safety training of airline pilots. But the cockpit is a microcosm of any working organization. The cost-effectiveness of emotional intelligence is a relatively new idea for business, one some managers may find hard to accept. A study of 250 executives found that most felt their work demanded their heads but not their hearts. Many said they feared that feeling empathy or compassion for those they worked with would put them in conflict with their organizational goals. That study was done in the 1970s, when the business environment was very different. My argument is that such attitudes are outmoded, a luxury of a former day. A new competitive reality is putting emotional intelligence at a premium in the workplace and in the marketplace. As Shoshana Zuboff, a psychologist at Harvard Business School, pointed out to me, corporations have gone through a radical revolution within this century, and with this has come a corresponding transformation of the emotional landscape. There was a long period of managerial domination of the corporate hierarchy, when the manipulative jungle fighter boss was rewarded. But that rigid hierarchy started breaking down in the 1980s, under the twin pressures of globalization and information technology. The jungle fighter symbolizes where the corporation has been. The virtuoso in interpersonal skills is the corporate future. Some of the reasons are patently obvious. Imagine the consequences for a working group when someone is unable to keep from exploding in anger or has no sensitivity about what the people around him are feeling. When emotionally upset, people can't remember, attend, learn, or make decisions clearly. As one management consultant put it, stress makes people stupid. Some of the less obvious reasons emotional aptitudes are moving to the forefront of business skills reflect sweeping changes in the workplace. Let me make my point by tracking the differences two applications of emotional intelligence make. One is in being able to air grievances as helpful critiques, the other in effective teamwork. Criticism is one of the most important tasks a manager has, yet too many managers have poorly mastered the crucial art of feedback. The emotional vicissitudes at work and marriage also operate in the workplace, where they take similar forms. Criticisms are voiced as personal attacks rather than complaints that can be acted upon. Many managers are too willing to criticize but frugal with praise, leaving their employees feeling that they only hear about how they're doing when they make a mistake. Consider the alternative. An artful critique can be one of the most helpful messages a manager can send. An artful critique focuses on what a person has done and can do, rather than reading a mark of character into a job poorly done. As one industrial psychologist observes, a character attack, calling someone stupid or incompetent, misses the point. You immediately put him on the defensive so that he's no longer receptive to what you have to tell him about how to do things better. That advice, of course, is precisely the same as for married couples airing their grievances. Harry Levinson, a psychoanalyst turned corporate consultant, gives the following advice on the art of the critique, which is intricately entwined with the art of praise. Be specific. Pick a significant incident, an event that illustrates a key problem that needs changing or a pattern of deficiency, such as the inability to do certain parts of a job well. Offer a solution. The critique, like all useful feedback, should point a way to fix the problem. Be present. Critiques, like praise, are most effective face-to-face and in private. Be sensitive. This is a call for empathy, for being attuned to the impact of what you say and how you say it on the person at the receiving end. By the end of the century, a third of the American workforce will be knowledge workers, people whose productivity is marked by adding value to information, whether as market analysts, writers, or computer programmers. Peter Drucker, the eminent business maven who coined the term knowledge worker, points out that such workers' expertise is highly specialized and that their productivity depends on their efforts being coordinated as part of an organizational team. While people have always worked in tandem, notes Drucker, teams become the work unit rather than the individual himself. And that suggests why emotional intelligence, the skills that help people harmonize, should become increasingly valued as a workplace asset in the years to come. Electronic networks, email, teleconferences, work teams, informal networks, and the like are emerging as new functional entities and organizations. To the degree that the explicit hierarchy, as mapped on an organizational chart, is the skeleton of an organization, these human touch points are its central nervous system. Whenever people come together to collaborate, whether it be in an executive planning meeting or as a team working toward a shared product or decision, there's a very real sense in which they have a group IQ, the sum total of the talents and skills of all those involved. And how well they accomplish their task will be determined by how high that IQ is. The single most important element in group intelligence is not the average IQ in the academic sense, but rather in terms of emotional intelligence. The key to a high group IQ is social harmony. It's this ability to harmonize that, all other things being equal, will make one group especially talented, productive, and successful, and another, with members whose talent and skill are equal in other regards, do poorly. Consider, for example, a study of engineers, star performers at Bell Labs, the world-famous scientific think tank near Princeton. What makes the difference between stars and the others is not their academic IQ, but their emotional IQ. They're better able to motivate themselves and better able to work their informal networks into ad hoc teams. The stars were studied by Robert Kelly and Janet Kaplan, who wrote in the Harvard Business Review, "As it develops, academic talent was not a good predictor of on-the-job productivity, nor was IQ. The critical strategy the stars used to get the work done included a rapport with a network of key people." Informal networks are especially critical for handling unanticipated problems. The formal organization is set up to handle easily anticipated problems, one study of these networks observes. But when unexpected problems arise, the informal organization kicks in. Its complex web of social ties form every time colleagues communicate and solidify over time into surprisingly stable networks. As knowledge-based services and intellectual capital become more central to corporations, improving the way people work together will be a major way to leverage intellectual capital, making a critical competitive difference. To thrive, if not survive, corporations would do well to boost their collective emotional intelligence. A vague ache in my groin sent me to my doctor. Nothing seemed unusual until he looked at the results of a urine test. I had traces of blood in my urine. My doctor said, "I want you to go to the hospital and get some tests, kidney function and cytology." I don't know what he said next. My mind seemed to freeze at the word cytology, cancer. I have a foggy memory of his explaining to me when and where to go for diagnostic tests. It was the simplest instruction, but I had to ask him to repeat it 3 or 4 times. Why should I have reacted so strongly? My doctor was just being thorough and competent, checking the limbs in a diagnostic decision tree. There was a tiny likelihood that cancer was the problem, But this rational analysis was irrelevant at that moment. In the land of the sick, emotions reign supreme. Fear is a thought away. The problem is when medical personnel ignore how patients are reacting emotionally, even while attending to their physical condition. This inattention to the emotional reality of illness neglects a growing body of evidence showing that people's emotional states can play a sometimes significant role in their vulnerability to disease and in the course of their recovery. Modern medical care too often lacks emotional intelligence. By now, a scientific case can be made that there's a margin of medical effectiveness, both in prevention and treatment, that can be gained by treating people's emotional state along with their medical condition. In 1974, a finding at the School of Medicine and Dentistry at the University of Rochester rewrote biology's map of the body. Robert Ader, a psychologist, discovered that the immune system, like the brain, could learn. His result was a shock. The prevailing wisdom in medicine had been that only the brain and central nervous system could respond to experience by changing how they behaved. Ader's finding led to the investigation of what are turning out to be myriad ways the central nervous system and the immune system communicate. Biological pathways that make the mind, the emotions, and the body not separate, but intimately entwined. The immune system is the body's brain, as neuroscientist Francisco Varela puts it, defining the body's own sense of self, of what belongs within it and what does not. Immune cells travel in the bloodstream throughout the entire body, contacting virtually every other cell. Those cells they recognize, they leave alone. Those they fail to recognize, they attack. The attack either defends us against viruses, bacteria, and cancer, or, if the immune cells misidentify some of the body's own cells, creates an autoimmune disease such as allergy or lupus. A network of researchers is finding that the chemical messengers that operate most extensively in both brain and immune system are those that are most dense in neural areas that regulate emotion. One key pathway linking emotions in the immune system is via the influence of the hormones released under stress. Each has a strong impact on immune cells. While the relationships are complex, the main influence is that while these hormones surge through the body, the immune cells are hampered in their function. But if stress is constant and intense, that suppression may become long-lasting. Now scientists are finding more and more such connections between the brain and the cardiovascular and immune systems, having first had to accept the once radical notion that these connections exist at all. Now studies of links between emotions and health show that people who are chronically upset, constantly irritable or anxious, for example, have double the risk for getting a major disease. That makes constant emotional distress a greater health risk factor than smoking. Despite such evidence, many or most physicians are still skeptical that emotions matter clinically. One reason is that while many studies have found stress and negative emotions to weaken the effectiveness of various immune cells, it's not always clear that the range of these changes is great enough to make a medical difference. Taking a more detailed look at the data for specific emotions, especially the big three, anger, anxiety, and depression, makes clear some specific ways that feelings have medical significance, even if the biological mechanisms by which such emotions have their effect are yet to be fully understood. There's evidence emerging from dozens of studies pointing to the power of anger to damage the heart. The old idea has not held up that a hurried, high-pressure type A personality is at great risk from heart disease, but from that failed theory has emerged a new finding. It's hostility that puts people at risk. Much of the data on hostility has come from research by Dr. Redford Williams at Duke University. For example, Williams found that those physicians who had the highest scores on a test of hostility while still in medical school were 7 times as likely to have died by the age of 50 as were those with low hostility scores. Being prone to anger was a stronger predictor of dying young than were other risk factors such as smoking, high blood pressure, even high cholesterol. Once heart disease develops, the mechanisms triggered by anger affect the very efficiency of the heart as a pump. This makes anger particularly lethal in those who already have heart disease. The strongest scientific links between emotions and heart disease are to anger. A Harvard Medical School study asked more than 1,500 men and women who had suffered heart attacks to describe their emotional state in the hours before the attack. Being angry more than doubled the risk of cardiac arrest in people who already had heart disease. The heightened risk lasted for about 2 hours after the anger was aroused. The hopeful news is that chronic anger need not be a death sentence. Hostility is a habit that can change. As Williams told me, the antidote to hostility is to develop a more trusting heart. All it takes is the right motivation. When people see that their hostility can lead to an early grave, they're ready to try. Anxiety, the distress evoked by life's pressures, is perhaps the emotion with the greatest weight of scientific evidence connecting it to the onset of sickness and the course of recovery. When anxiety helps us prepare to deal with some danger, a presumed utility in evolution, then it serves us well. But in modern life, anxiety is more often out of proportion and out of place. Distress comes in the face of situations that we must live with or that are conjured by the mind, not real dangers we need to confront. Repeated bouts of anxiety signal high levels of stress. Particularly compelling evidence for the medical impact from distress has come from studies with infectious diseases such as colds, the flu, and herpes. We're continually exposed to such viruses, but ordinarily our immune system fights them off, except that under emotional stress, those defenses more often fail. The toll of anxiety is not just that it lowers the immune response. Other research is showing adverse effects on the cardiovascular system. While chronic hostility and repeated episodes of anger seem to put men at greatest risk for heart disease, the more deadly emotions in women may be anxiety and fear. Understandably, health risks seem greatest for those whose jobs are high in strain. In a study of 569 patients with colorectal cancer and a matched comparison group, those who said that in the previous 10 years they had experienced severe on-the-job aggravation were 5.5 times more likely to have developed the cancer compared to those with no such stress in their lives. Because the medical toll of distress is so broad, relaxation techniques, which directly counter the physiological arousal of stress, are being used clinically to ease the symptoms of a wide variety of chronic illnesses. Evidence is mounting that for patients with serious disease who are depressed, it would pay medically to treat the depression too. One complication in treating depression in medical patients is that its symptoms, including loss of appetite and lethargy, are easily mistaken for signs of other diseases, particularly by physicians with little training in psychiatric diagnosis. The failure to diagnose and treat may add to the risk of death in severe disease. For instance, of 100 patients who received bone marrow transplants, 12 of 13 who had been depressed died within the first year of the transplant, while 34 of the remaining 87 were still alive 2 years later. The cumulative evidence for adverse medical effects from anger, anxiety, and depression, then, is compelling. But if chronic emotional distress in its many forms is toxic, the opposite range of emotion can be tonic, to a degree. This by no means says that positive emotion is curative or that laughter or happiness alone will turn the course of a serious disease. But like its near cousin, optimism, hope has healing power. People who have a great deal of hopefulness are, understandably, better able to bear up under trying circumstances, including medical difficulties. Also, the quality of relationships, as well as their sheer number, seems key to buffering stress. Negative relationships take their own toll. Marital arguments, for example, have a negative impact on the immune system. Ohio State University psychologist John Cacioppo told me, "It's the most important relationships in your life, the people you see day in and day out, that seem to be crucial for your health. And the more significant the relationship is in your life, the more it matters for your health." Perhaps the most powerful demonstration of the clinical power of emotional support was in groups at Stanford University Medical School for women with advanced metastatic breast cancer. After an initial treatment, often including surgery, these women's cancer had returned and was spreading through their bodies. It was only a matter of time, clinically speaking, until the spreading cancer killed them. Dr. David Spiegel, who conducted the study, was himself stunned by the findings, as was the medical community. Women with advanced breast cancer who went to weekly meetings with others survived twice as long as did women with the same disease who faced it on their own. There are many ways medicine can expand its view of health to include the emotional realities of illness. For one, patients could routinely be offered fuller information essential to the decisions they must make about their own medical care. Moments when patients face surgery or invasive and painful tests are fraught with anxiety and are a prime opportunity to deal with the emotional dimension. Some hospitals have developed pre-surgery instructions for patients that help them assuage their fears, for example, by teaching patients relaxation techniques, answering their questions well in advance of surgery, and telling them several days ahead of surgery precisely what they're likely to experience during their recovery. The result? Patients recover from surgery an average of 2 or 3 days sooner. There's the added medical value of an empathic physician or nurse attuned to patients, able to listen and be heard. This means recognizing that the relationship between physician and patient is itself a factor of significance. Such steps are a beginning, but for medicine to enlarge its vision to embrace the impact of emotions, two large implications of the scientific findings must be taken to heart. For one, helping people better manage their upsetting feelings is a form of disease prevention. One way to do this that could have broad public health effects would be to impart the most basic emotional intelligence skills to children so that they become lifelong habits. Another high-payoff preventive strategy would be to teach emotion management to people reaching retirement age, since emotional well-being is one factor that determines whether an older person declines rapidly or thrives. A third target group might be so-called at-risk populations, the very poor, single working mothers, residents of high crime neighborhoods and the like, who live under extraordinary pressure day in and day out, and so might do better medically with help in handling the emotional toll of these stresses. Many patients can benefit measurably when their psychological needs are attended to along with their purely medical ones. There may be a business advantage to humane medicine. Treating emotional distress in patients, early evidence suggests, can save money, especially to the extent that it prevents or delays the onset of sickness or helps patients heal more quickly. Finally, medical ethics may demand such an approach. An editorial in the Journal of the American Medical Association commented, "The clear demonstration that psychological factors like depression and social isolation distinguish the coronary heart disease patients at highest risk means it would be unethical not to start trying to treat these factors." It's time for medicine to take more methodical advantage of the link between emotion and health. What's now the exception could and should be part of the mainstream, so that a more caring medicine is available to us all. At the least, it would make medicine more humane, and for some it could speed the course of recovery. Compassion, as one patient put it in an open letter to his surgeon, is not mere hand-holding. It's good medicine. The impact of parenting on emotional competence starts in the cradle. Dr. T. Barry Brazelton, the eminent Harvard pediatrician, has a simple diagnostic test of a baby's basic outlook toward life. He offers 2 blocks to an 8-month-old and then shows the baby how he wants her to put the 2 blocks together. A baby who's hopeful about life, who has confidence in her own ability, says Brazelton, will pick up 1 block, mouth it, rub it in her hair, drop it over the side of the table, watching to see whether you'll retrieve it for her. When you do, she finally completes the requested task, place the 2 blocks together. Then she looks up at you with a bright-eyed look of expectancy that says, "Tell me how great I am." Babies like these have gotten a goodly dose of approval and encouragement from the adults in their lives. They expect to succeed in life's little challenges. By contrast, babies who come from homes too bleak, chaotic, or neglectful go about the same small task in a way that signals they already expect to fail. It's not that these babies fail to bring the blocks together. They understand the instruction and have the coordination to comply, but even when they do, reports Brazelton, their demeanor is hangdog, a look that says, "I'm no good, see I failed." Such children, says Brazelton, are likely to go through life with a defeatist outlook, expecting no encouragement or interest from teachers, finding school joyless, perhaps eventually dropping out. The first opportunity for shaping the ingredients of emotional intelligence is in the earliest years, though these capacities continue to form throughout the school years and into adolescence. A child's readiness for school depends on the most basic of all knowledge, how to learn. One report lists the 7 key ingredients of this crucial capacity, all related to emotional intelligence. 1. Confidence. The child sensed that he is more likely than not to succeed at what he undertakes and that adults will be helpful. 2. Curiosity, the sense that finding out about things is positive and leads to pleasure. 3. Intentionality, the wish and capacity to have an impact and to act upon that with persistence. 4. Self-control, the ability to modulate and control one's own actions in age-appropriate ways. 5. Relatedness, the ability to engage with others based on the sense of being understood by and understanding others. 6. The capacity to communicate. And 7. Cooperativeness. Whether or not a child arrives at school on the first day of kindergarten with these capabilities depends greatly on how much her parents and preschool teachers have given her the kind of care that amounts to a Heart Start, the emotional equivalent of the Head Start programs. Emotional learning begins in life's earliest moments and continues throughout childhood. All the small exchanges between parent and child have an emotional subtext, and in the repetition of these messages over the years, children form the core of their emotional outlook and capabilities. A little girl who finds a puzzle frustrating and asks her busy mother to help gets one message if the reply is the mother's clear pleasure at the request, quite another if it's a curt, "Don't bother me, I've got important work to do." When such encounters become typical of child and parent, they mold the child's emotional expectations about relationships, outlooks that will flavor her functioning in all realms of life for better or worse. The risks are greatest for those children whose parents are grossly inept, immature, abusing drugs, depressed or chronically angry, or simply aimless in living chaotic lives. Simple neglect, studies find, can be more damaging than outright abuse. A survey of maltreated children found the neglected youngsters doing the worst of all. They were the most anxious, inattentive, and apathetic, alternately aggressive and withdrawn. The rate for having to repeat first grade among them was 65%. The first 3 or 4 years of life are a period when the toddler's brain grows to about two-thirds its full size, and it evolves in complexity at a greater rate than it ever will again. During this period, key kinds of learning take place more readily than later in life, emotional learning foremost among them. During this time, severe stress can impair the brain's learning centers and so be damaging to the intellect. Though, as we shall see, this can be remedied to some extent by experiences later in life, the impact of this early learning is profound. As one report sums up the key emotional lessons of life's first 4 years, the lasting consequences are great. A child who cannot focus his attention, who's suspicious rather than trusting, sad or angry rather than optimistic, destructive rather than respectful, and one who's overcome with anxiety, preoccupied with frightening fantasy, and feels generally unhappy about himself, such a child has little opportunity at all, let alone equal opportunity, to claim the possibilities of the world as his own. In the rough-and-tumble play of the daycare center, Martin, just 2 and a half, brushed up against a little girl who inexplicably broke out crying. Martin reached for her hand, but as the sobbing girl moved away, Martin slapped her on the arm. As her tears continued, Martin looked away and yelled, "Cut it out!" over and over, each time faster and louder. When Martin then made another attempt to pat her, again she resisted. This time Martin bared his teeth like a snarling dog, hissing at the sobbing girl. Once more Martin started patting the crying girl, but the pats on the back quickly turned into pounding, and Martin went on hitting and hitting the poor little girl, despite her screams. That disturbing encounter testifies to how abuse, being beaten repeatedly at the whim of a parent's moods, warps a child's natural bent toward empathy. Martin's violent response to distress may well mirror the lessons he learned at home about tears and anguish. For abused children, crying is met at first with a peremptory, consoling gesture, but if it continues, the progression is from nasty looks and shouts to hitting to outright beating. Perhaps most troubling, Martin already seems to lack the most primitive sort of empathy. At 2 and a half, he displays the budding moral impulses of a cruel and sadistic brute. The callousness of abused children is simply a more extreme version of that seen in children whose parents are critical, threatening, and overly harsh in their punishments. What's perhaps most troubling about the abused toddlers is how early they seem to have learned to respond like miniature versions of their own abusive parents. Perhaps the most instructive paradigm for understanding the emotional learning abused children have undergone is in seeing how trauma can leave a lasting imprint on the brain. and how even these savage imprints can be mended. Victims of a devastating trauma may never be the same biologically, Dr. Dennis Charney, a Yale psychiatrist, told me. He adds, "It doesn't matter if it was the incessant terror of combat, torture, or repeated abuse."